Hello, and welcome to The Scoop, a provincial newscast and podcast with stories from LJI journalists around British Columbia. Each week, reporters from Revelstoke, Cortez Island, Kootenay, Terrace, Prince George, and Smithers will share the news affecting their place in BC. I'm your host and producer, Pamela Hassan, from CICK News in Smithers. The Scoop was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative Program, or LJI. Follow The Scoop on CICK Smithers Community Radio 93.9 FM every Thursday at noon, online at smithersradio.com, and wherever you get your podcasts. Here's this week's Scoop, Smoke and the Water. Gidenmak Mackay and Rupert Meats have started a new company selling delicious smoked salmon. CFNR's Sabrina Spencer has the scoop. There's a sneaky new pipeline in the process of getting approved under a decade-old environmental assessment in the Skeena region. CICK News is speaking to Gitanyau Representative Tara Marsden about it. Bill C-18, we keep hearing about it, that Online News Act. But Google and Canadian feds have come to an agreement, and Stoke FM's Megan Dooling has the scoop. Good news comes by way of Friends of Cortez Island, or FOCI, an organization celebrating 33 years on Cortez. Kim Polly spreads the good word. Training new firefighters is a time-consuming thing, but the regional district of Central Kootenay thinks they've found a workaround. This story is by Scott Onychuk. The ecosystem in the Nechaco region is stressed. River water levels are disturbingly low, and CFIRS' Ian Gregg gets to the silty bottom of it all.
Today we're speaking to Dr. Stefan Deary, professor in the Department of Geography, Earth, and Environmental Science at UMBC. The Nechaco River watershed is experiencing drought, and the Nechaco River itself is the lowest that many people in the city have ever seen it. Is this a cause for alarm, Doctor?
It's a very good question, and indeed, if you're walking on the banks of the Nechaco River or the Fraser, you will have seen the very low levels. And, of course, there is concern about, you know, the ongoing drought. This started actually in, I think, June of last year, and obviously we've experienced below average precipitation since then. And in fact, in Prince George, I think we've experienced about 50% or 57% of the usual precipitation for 2023 thus far. So it is obviously a dry period we've been experiencing leading to those low water levels that we see in the Nechaco.
We can't predict the future, but I'm going to imagine that seeing the river this low is a predictive measure of how dry things will likely be next year as well, no?
Absolutely. It is certainly a harbinger of what might be coming because we're entering actually the low flow season in northern British Columbia. So typically the rivers will be descending in terms of water levels up until late winter, if not early spring, unless we get some rain this winter, but usually by this time of the year, we have sub-freezing conditions and not rain. So definitely it is a concern that already we're hitting such low levels in our rivers and lakes. And so with El Nino developing as well, we're anticipating perhaps below average precipitation this winter. So yeah, definitely a potential harbinger of things to come for next spring and summer.
And is it as straightforward as simply the lack of precipitation led to drought, or are there other contributing factors why the river is as low as it is?
Definitely it is the lack of precipitation. And we've seen below average precipitation in Prince George since June 2022. And there's only one month during the last, I think, 18 months where we had above precipitation. That was February of 2023. So the lack of precipitation means lack of soil moisture and ultimately, you know, lack of runoff into our lakes and rivers. And that is leading to essentially those low water levels that we're experiencing right now.
Does a lower water flow in the Nechaco present either less of a risk or more of a risk of ice dams forming?
I believe that if we would get a very cold spell at some point, that actually that might lead to the potential for increased ice jams. Depends on the combination of factors. You know, the low water levels may not necessarily be the sole factor that would enhance ice jam presence, but certainly if we get a really cold spell, you know, sometimes we do get those in January, we'll have to have a close eye on the Nechaco itself because, yeah, that water could freeze up pretty quickly.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM.
The Prince Rupert Gas Transmission, or PRGT, is a pipeline that has been approved to run through the Skeena region without any consultation from the nation Tara Marsden represents, the Gitignau. This pipeline would threaten livelihoods of the Gitignau, who are concerned that the timeline of this project looms too close for comfort. Tara is speaking about the two key areas of potential impact of the project on Gitignau rights and interest, and what the Gitignau hereditary chiefs are proposing in order to move forward for the potential Gitignau review of the project under the WILP sustainability assessment process.
Hello, this is Tara Marsden. My Gitsan name is Nachgink, and I work with the Gitignau hereditary chiefs as well as other consulting work on lands and resources issues in the northwest of BC, and I live in Hazelton.
What are the areas of concern or problematic or misleading characterization of climate impacts that you've noted on the project?
The first one is the project splitting, and so understanding things as a whole. The other is the mitigation approaches. And so they're relying on these uncertain frameworks, and this is very common in Crown-led assessments, is that there's always a future-looking promises. And so the mitigation measures aren't well described currently. That this project is likely going to jeopardize both provincial and federal climate targets. And that this is something that, you know, these, even though these are Crown targets, Gitignau supports these through our own WILP sustainability assessment process, because they are a starting place for reducing overall greenhouse gas emissions. One of these mitigation or ways that they propose to get to net zero for xylisms is to connect to the hydroelectricity grid. And so that, again, relies on available power. It may be power that is diverted from other needs and other community needs, especially in our region. And so there's just a lot of things that haven't been, I would say, worked out yet. And we also are looking at the fisheries component of this project. And so when the pipeline was proposed to go to Lilu Island, we learned about the significant habitat that was going to be impacted by the terminal. And in that case, it was the Skeena estuary. And as our salmon are migrating out from the rivers, they are quite sensitive. They're juveniles. They're sort of like teenagers. And they are transitioning from freshwater to saltwater. And they really are at a vulnerable life stage. And so in that case, the evidence brought forward was significant enough in terms of impacts that Lilu Island was eventually protected by the Port of Prince Rupert and is no longer being explored as an LNG terminal site. We don't know as much about the Nass estuary, but we're looking at the fisheries assessments done by the proponent so far. And in the area, the project area, they have found a number of juvenile salmon, including all species of salmon, caught during their test surveys and caught during that time where they would likely be transitioning from the freshwater to the saltwater. So we're looking at a need for genetic analysis. And so Gitignau is upriver. So we're not talking about this being our territory. This is Nishka territory that they're proposing to develop. But we have upriver impacts because those salmon will migrate as adults up to spawn in our territory in the mid and upper Nass. And so we harvest salmon as adults, around 10,000 pieces per year of sockeye, and the Chinook are actually threatened. And so they did find juvenile Chinook in the project area. And there's just a big concern, I think, about the risk that it poses to salmon. Sockeye are doing quite well currently, but the Chinook are in a real serious state of decline and potential extinction in future years. And so we're looking at both of those pieces for this project.
The salmon and the livelihood of salmon was a big part of the WILP sustainability assessment process. Are there other elements to that process that you can share as well?
Sure. So our WILP sustainability assessment process was developed by our hereditary chiefs and our staff. And we are trying to run a parallel process, essentially. We've participated in many Crown or colonial government environmental assessments, and they have really been found wanting in terms of sustainability and the ability to say no. Most of these projects, once they're in an environmental assessment process with the Crown, they end up getting approved. It's just a matter of what mitigation measures or what conditions are put in an environmental certificate. But we would like, in accordance with the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, we would like the ability to say yes or no to projects that have an impact, a potential impact to Kitikmeot and our territories and the resources that may migrate through our territories. So we can scope and only look at those things that affect Kitikmeot. And so in this case, as I mentioned, it's the climate, the connection to the pipeline, as well as potential fisheries impacts to upriver resources that we utilize and harvest each year.
In June of this year, the Government of Canada enacted a new law called Bill C-18, the Online News Act, requiring Google and Meta companies to pay for showing links to news. The decision to require compensation to Canadian media organizations, a so-called link tax, resulted in Google removing links to Canadian news from their search, new, and discover products in Canada, and Meta, the company that owns Facebook and Instagram, no longer shares content from any news organization in Canada unless they pay for advertising. On Wednesday, November 29th, the Canadian government reached a deal with Google over the Online News Act that will see the tech giant pay $100 million annually to publishers and continue to allow access to Canadian news content on its platform. Stoke FM's Megan Dooling spoke to the National Campus and Community Radio Association's executive director, Barry Rook, about this landmark deal for Canadian news organizations.
As of right now, what we understand is there are two companies that are captured in the legislation. One is Meta, which has Facebook and Instagram. The other is Google. We are also aware that there's two or three companies that are close to the threshold of being involved in the regulations as they go forward. The two that I've heard that have named are Bing, the other search alternative, and TikTok. How many people get their news and information from TikTok, I can't speak to that, but they're possibly large enough to be able to manage that. And the other name that I've seen or heard thrown around is Apple. The government of Canada is sort of the second government to approach these groups and try to make some of these groups help pay for what's happening domestically. The first was in Australia. Both Google and Meta were implemented in that process. They both pushed back. There was a loophole found, which got them out of the process, and essentially people moved forward. Government of Canada saw that process, said, hey, I guess we're next in line, went forward that process and kind of closed the loophole that was brought into place. Meta has essentially said, this is too rich for them. News and that type of information is not part of what their platform is. And they've divested news from the entire process. And they don't view it as a major impact in their organizations. And as a result, we're going to be left out of that process. What happens to our stations who were blocked is still up in the air, because if there's no reason for us to be a pawn in this discussion, maybe Meta will unblock them because we can't share news and information anyways. Maybe they'll keep them blocked and we have to find another workaround. So the Meta element is still very much up in the air, but I would not put as a primary expectation or goal as we go forward.
Barry Rook is the executive director of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
The charitable organization Friends of Cortez Island, or FOCI, exists to monitor and preserve the health of local ecosystems and to provide educational programs that foster a greater understanding of the natural environment. Through all of their projects, they work to promote environmental integrity through community responsibility. They celebrated 33 years on Cortez Island, and CKTZ's Kim Polly is talking to Executive Director Helen Hall.
What's so special about FOCI's AGM this year?
It's actually Giving Tuesday, so we're launching an appeal to raise $10,000 to support our work. This year we're trying something new. We've decided this year that what we wanted to do is get a lot more people to know about our work. Last year we only had 15 people turn up, and we just talked to a very small audience. We've also just published our very first annual report, which celebrates all the different projects and work that we've been doing. We're hoping that we can get that out to as wide an audience as possible.
So that's a first ever, and is a film documenting the year's work also a first ever?
I think so. I think we're doing a lot of really great projects, but often we're out in the world doing those projects and people aren't seeing what we're doing. The different projects, whether it's looking for screech owls, managing our parks, looking after the Dillon Creek wetland. A newish project to us was the invasive green crab monitoring that we've been doing with Department of Fisheries and Ocean, which is trying to look for this very invasive crab on Cortez. It's spreading up and down the coast and it damages ecosystems, it outcompetes other species. And what we've been doing with that is we've been trapping in Manson's Lagoon to try and find them. Luckily, we didn't find any. We've also been taking water samples to test for their DNA in Cortez Bay. And so far, we haven't found any there too. But if we do find them, then DFO would come in and try and eliminate them. That's a new and really important project for us.
Your annual report was highlighting the numbers on things that you did. And I also noticed there were two screech owls.
Yes, this has been a fabulous project that we've been running now. We were doing that by going all over the island, right up into the north by boat, doing two things. One, going out and doing something called a call playback survey, where you play the call of the owl on a predetermined route and you hope that the owl calls back. We spent weeks doing that, and finally Sabina actually went up by boat to the north of the island, played from the boat a screech owl call and got one call back. And she did that in two places, so we assume there's at least two owls. The western screech owls used to be abundant on the BC coast, and now their numbers have declined dramatically. The fact we've still got them on Cortez just holding on in the north of the island is really exciting. We also put up what's called autonomous recording units. They're a bit like a wildlife camera, but they're for sound. They were up in a bunch of different locations on Cortez, and we had them up for a different number of different weeks, and then we got the data from that we've given to the ministry biologists we've been working with, and they're analysing that data. Another project I'd like to mention is all the parks and trails work we do. And when I was drawing up our annual report, I tried to measure exactly how far that was. I worked out that every month we maintain 19 kilometres of trails. It's almost we're doing it in the background, and a lot of people go into the parks and trails, they don't realise who's maintaining it, but that's a really important part of our brief, to maintain the parks and trails and make them accessible and beautiful places for people to go and visit.
And easily walk.
Exactly. Yeah. We've been on top of our monthly trail clearance work. We've been putting in boardwalks. We've putting in new signage. We're doing a bunch of other projects. So when you mysteriously see the moon trail has been completely replaced on all the boardwalks, that's a foci project. I think that's great work. I hope it's also really appreciated by the community.
I would think a particular challenge at this time is the wildfires and the drought. How does Foci mobilise around that?
Some of the things we've done, like the Dillon Creek wetland, for example, where we've recreated wetlands at Lanier Farm, that's helping to hold water, that's helping to mitigate a bit the impacts of climate change. But it's a big question, and we're near a piece of the puzzle trying to figure out how to adapt to that. One small thing we have done, the Room for Rider programme, which was to encourage people to reduce their impacts on CO2 emissions. The idea behind that was people would share rides to get across Quadrant Island. We printed 500 mirror tags, and we've got about 50 left. So there's a lot out there.
There's a lot out there.
And we put posters up in all the waiting rooms and all the ferries, and we've done various promotions. We're trying to help the community help other people in the community to get across Quadra. I don't know how to measure that one.
Was there a very special favourite moment from this past year for you?
Yes, there was. There was an amazing, very special morning for me in the summer. We're very lucky to have Manuel Padisa as our summer student this summer. We got a call into the office saying there were some dolphins off the government dock at Manson's. And we'd already been out in the morning, and somebody phoned 2 hours ago about these dolphins. Manuel and I decided, right, we're just going to go drive down there, see if they're still there, not thinking they would be there at all. And we walked to the end of the government dock, and lo and behold, there were like 30 or 40 dolphins just off the dock feeding in the water. And it was just the most amazing sight. They were leaping and diving. And what was more amazing for me was that Manuel was so excited. He turned around to me and said, "Helen, can I swim with them?" And I said, "Yeah, we have to keep the right distance, but yes, sure." And before I knew it, he'd stripped off his T-shirt and he dove backwards into the water and then swam out towards where these other boats were watching the dolphins. And it was just so joyful. And then after a while, he swam and he got out of the water and he was just over the moon. It was like celebrating this young person being in nature, learning about nature and just having this amazing experience in nature. And it says it all. Right? You know, that's what we're doing. We're here to celebrate and enjoy nature. I would say it was probably my best ever morning at work. I just wanted to swim with dolphins. I never thought I'd do it as part of a summer student job on Cortez.
Kim Pauley, CKTZ News, Cortez Island.
The Regional District of Central Kootenai is implementing a new structured recruitment program for volunteer firefighters. The goal of the program is to create a regional approach to training that will see volunteers train as a cohort and be ready for active duty in a quicker time frame beginning this month. Scott Onychuk is speaking to Tristan Feist, the Regional Deputy Fire Chief for RDCK, who says the program will significantly reduce the time needed to train volunteers.
Yeah, so typically it could take a few months, but it could also take up to over a year. It's sort of at the discretion at the moment of availability of the volunteer and the other volunteers to train that person. So this process, we're hoping to speed it up and condense it and use our regional staff to train them up in over a three-month period.
In the past, each fire department has been responsible for recruiting and training their own firefighters. Under the new program, the goal is to hold a recruitment drive twice a year and train the incoming volunteers at the RDCK Fire Training Academy before sending them off to their respective fire departments.
So we're going to have open houses where potential applicants can come out and see what a training night looks like.
While the main goal of the new recruitment program is to reduce the time it takes to train volunteers, some of the fire halls have found it difficult to recruit new volunteers, and the RDCK is hoping this process will help.
Typically, it can be challenging. We understand that people are busy. These are volunteer organizations, and we're asking people to put in a lot of time into the process. We're hoping with this process is by having everything laid out ahead of time and being transparent about how much workload and how much training is required, hopefully people can see that structure coming into the process and get motivated and understand whether they're ready to commit to that structure or that time load as well.
All RDCK fire departments must have a minimum of 15 volunteers, but ideally that number is 20 plus per department. If you're interested in becoming a firefighter, visit rdck.ca/volunteer. Reporting in Nelson, Scott Onychuk, KCR News.
The Gidinmak Makai Nishka Society and Rupert Meats came together in a joint venture to release the new product, Wilp Sahone Smokehouse First Nations Smoked Salmon. CFNR talked with Blair Miro, Chief Executive Officer of the Gidinmak Makai, as well as Craig Summers, the owner and operator of Rupert Meats. They told CFNR about what this joint venture means to both companies, the city of Prince Rupert, and where and when you'll be able to find their delicious product.
So my name is Blair Miro. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Gidinmak Makai Nishka Society.
Craig Summers, owner of Rupert Meats.
So it's a partnership between Rupert Meats, which is locally owned and operated meat shop, as well as the Gidinmak Makai Nishka Society. And we're a nonprofit organization that represents approximately 1,400 Nishka citizens that live in Prince Rupert and Port Edward.
And what exactly is this partnership?
So we have joined together to develop a line of smoked or value-added salmon products over this next year. There's a name for the smoked salmon, Wilp Sahone.
Essentially, our organization has been experimenting with and trying to launch our own brand of smoked salmon. And whether it was licensing requirements or staffing or physical space limitations, a whole bunch of different obstacles. And once we were approached by Rupert Meats for the potential for a partnership, it just everything seemed to fall into place very quickly. So we felt like it was a good match.
So what does this joint venture mean between both the Gidinmak Makai and Rupert Meats?
What it means for us is It's a big mark of cultural pride to finally be able to launch our own brand of smoked salmon. It's been something that's been in the strategic plan for years.
We're able to give back to the folks up here. You know, typically, historically, and what has happened now with Prince Rupert is most of the fish processing and smoked fish, it's all shipped down to Lower Mainland Vancouver to be processed and smoked, and then very rarely some back up into the Prince Rupert area. So we're dependent on supply chain, dependent on others. And what we want to do is create a local brand of salmon from the harvester to landing, processing, and then retail. So we're able to create jobs. And, you know, the general overview, I think they're in an ideal position to become a seafood processing hub, you know, distribution, to bring organizations together and collectively develop solutions, chain issues, opportunities locally.
It's trying to find a way to take, you know, ancient recipes and use modern technology to make them available to more people. So we just want to find a way to get locally caught, locally processed salmon into the hands of locals.
So this being produced locally, I'm assuming that that'll, you know, help keep costs down?
That's right. I totally agree.
Is there anything else you'd like to add or share at all?
We're excited to see what the future brings us, to us in the next couple of years, and, you know, growing the relationship and the partnership from being able to harvest a sustainable resource and provide it back to, you know, what the historical value of the town was founded on. There's some real excitement about that.
This story is brought to you in partnership with the Local Journalism Initiative of Canada. You can see the full story at canada-info.ca.
And that's this week's Scoop. Be sure to tune in again every Thursday at noon on 93.9 FM Smithers Community Radio. The Scoop is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Find The Scoop on smithersradio.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Just look up BC Scoop.